Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. In discussing the literary method of Ayn Rand, I shall begin with a quotation from Miss Rand herself. Quote, "I decided to be a writer at the age of 9. It was a specific, conscious decision. I remember the day and the hour. I did not start by trying to describe the folks next door, but by inventing people who did things the folks next door would never do. I could summon no interest or enthusiasm for people as they are, when I had in my mind a blinding picture of people as they could be. I decided to become a writer, not in order to save the world, nor to serve my fellow men, but for the simple, personal, selfish, egoistical happiness of creating the kind of men and events I could like, respect, and admire. I can bear to look around me levelly. I cannot bear to look down. I wanted to look up. This attitude has never changed, but I went for years thinking that it was a strictly personal attitude toward fiction writing, never to be discussed and of no interest to anyone but me. Later, I discovered I had accepted as the rule of my life work a principle stated by Aristotle. Aristotle said that fiction is of greater philosophical importance than history, because history represents things only as they are, while fiction represents them as they might be and ought to be. If you wish a key to the literary method of my novels, this is it." Unquote. The projection of things as they might be and ought to be names the essence of Ayn Rand's concept of literature. In the wave of naturalism that has engulfed the literature of the 20th century, her novels are an outstanding exception. They are at once a continuation of the romantic tradition and a significant departure from the mainstream of that tradition. She is a romantic realist. Romantic because her work is concerned with values, with the essential, the abstract, the universal in human life, and with the projection of man as a heroic being. Realist because the values she selects pertain to this earth and to man's actual nature, and because the issues with which she deals are the crucial and fundamental ones of our age. Her novels do not represent a flight into mystical fantasy or the historical past, or into concerns that have little if any bearing on man's actual existence. Her heroes are not knights, gladiators, or adventurers in some impossible kingdom, but engineers, scientists, industrialists, men who belong on Earth, men who function in modern society. As a philosopher, she has brought ethics into the context of reason, reality, and man's life on Earth. As a novelist, she has brought the dramatic, the exciting, the heroic, the stylized into the same context. Just as in philosophy, she rejects every version of the mystic soul-body dichotomy, theory versus practice, thought versus action, morality versus happiness, so in literature she rejects the expression of this same dichotomy, the belief that a profound novel cannot be entertaining, and that an entertaining novel cannot be profound, that a serious philosophical novel cannot have a dramatic plot, and that a dramatic plot novel cannot possibly be serious or philosophical. Atlas Shrugged, the greatest of her novels, is an action story on a grand scale, but it is a consciously philosophical action story, just as its heroes are consciously philosophical men of action. To those who subscribe to the soul-body dichotomy in literature, Atlas Shrugged is a mystifying anomaly that defies classification by conventional standards. It moves effortlessly and ingeniously from economics to epistemology to morality to metaphysics to psychology to the theory of sex on the one hand, and on the other it has a chapter that ends with the heroine hurtling toward the earth in an aeroplane with a dead motor. It has a playboy crusader who blows up a multi-billion dollar industry, a philosopher turned pirate who attacks government relief ships, and a climax that involves the rescue of the hero from a torture chamber. Notwithstanding the austere solemnity of its abstract theme, her novel, as a work of art, projects the laughing, extravagantly imaginative virtuosity of a mind who has never heard that one is not supposed to combine such elements as these in a single book. To those who believe that one is not supposed to, Ayn Rand would answer, check your premises. Ayn Rand has written four novels, We the Living, Anthem, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and each of them has a major philosophical theme. Yet they are not propaganda novels. The primary purpose for which these books were written was not the philosophical conversion of their readers. The primary purpose was to project and make real the characters who are the book's heroes. This is the motive that unites the artist and the moralist. The desire to project the ideal man led to the writing of novels. The necessity of defining the premises that make an ideal man possible led to the formulating of the philosophical content of those novels. By its nature, every work of art projects implicitly or explicitly a metaphysics, that is, a fundamental view of man and of man's relation to existence. To be exact, it projects the emotional corollary of a metaphysics, a sense of life. It can project a tragic sense of life, or a heroic sense of life, or a benevolent sense of life, etc., according to the artist's basic psychological state and conscious or subconscious view of reality. But some sense of life, some estimate of existence and of man's place in it, is inescapably implicit in an artwork by the nature of the creative process. As illustration of this principle, contrast the heroic sense of life projected in the novels of the great romanticist Victor Hugo with the sordid and doomed sense of life conveyed in the novels of the arch-naturalist Emile Zola. Consider the literary means by which each writer's sense of life is projected. Where Hugo builds purposeful plot, Zola unravels calamitous contingency. Where Hugo dramatizes the conflict of crucial values, Zola describes the horror of torpid depravity. Where Hugo delineates characters in terms of their fundamental motivations, Zola lingers on the surface of accidental journalistic minutiae. Where Hugo presents life as exciting and man as a giant, Zola presents life as futility and man as a pygmy. Where Hugo sees literature as artistic creation, Zola sees literature as history, police gazette history. For good or evil, intentionally or otherwise, every work of art is a psychological confession. Through that which he chooses to present, an artist declares to the world, "This is what I think is important. Important for me to project and for others to perceive. This is the world as I see it. This is the essence of things. This is what matters." If a writer chooses to present as the chief object of his focus, intelligence, ability, integrity, and the pursuit and achievement of great and demanding values, he reveals one kind of soul and view of life. If another writer chooses to present as his chief object of focus mediocrity, helplessness, depravity, suffering, and defeat, he reveals a different kind of soul and view of life. In either case, what has been projected is a metaphysical estimate of man's existence, even if the author knows that estimate only in the form of an emotion, of that which feels right to him in the creative process. Emotions and feelings are not causeless. The most intensely anti-romantic slice of life writer cannot escape the fact that art deals with values and the artist's choice is only what kind of values will he present. Art deals with the essence of things, and the choice is only what does one take as the essence of things. What kind of sense of life will one project? Is it the genius or the psychotic who is to be taken as the representative of man? Is it efficacy or helplessness that fundamentally characterizes man's relation to existence? Is it achievement and happiness or failure and misery that constitute the essence of life? In the novels of Ayn Rand, the sense of life projected is conscious, deliberate, explicit, and philosophically implemented. It is as unique and unprecedented in literature as the premises from which it proceeds. It is a sense of life untouched by tragedy, untouched by any implication of metaphysical catastrophe or doom. Its essence is an unclouded and exaltedly benevolent view of existence, the sense of a universe in which man belongs, a universe in which triumph, enjoyment, and fulfillment are possible, although not guaranteed to man, and are to be achieved by the efficacy of his own effort. No matter how terrible their struggle, no matter how difficult the obstacles they encounter, the basic sense of life of Ayn Rand's heroes, as of the novels, is indestructibly affirmative and triumphant. Whether the characters achieve victory or, as in We the Living, suffer defeat, they do not regard pain and disaster as the normal, as the inevitable, but always as the abnormal, the exceptional, the unnatural. Ayn Rand shares with the romantic novelists of the 19th century the view of man as a being of free will, a being who is moved and whose course is determined not by fate or the gods or the irresistible power of tragic flaws, but by the values he has chosen. But she differs from those writers in the particular values she regards as proper to man, and as a consequence, she differs in her view of the nature of man's life on earth. Prior to the birth of the Romantic movement, the literature of Western civilization was dominated by the fate motif. Man was presented as the plaything, sometimes the defiantly rebellious, sometimes the sadly resigned, but almost always the defeated plaything, of an inexorable fate beyond his control which determined the ultimate course of his life, regardless of his choices, wishes, or actions. This is exemplified in the Greek tragedies, many of which were resolved by the arbitrary edict of a god, and in a different form in the plays of Shakespeare. In Shakespeare's dramas, man, for the most part, is not determined by the power of outside forces, but by uncontrollable passions or weaknesses within him, by the tragic flaw, which he cannot resist and which defeats all his hopes, plans, and intentions. Shakespeare presents heroic-sized figures, but he does not present man as a hero. He merely holds up a mirror to life, it is said. In one form or another, the plays, epic poems, sagas, and chronicles that preceded the rise of the novel carried the same message. Man is the pawn of destiny. He is caught in a universe essentially inimical to his interests. And if he ever does succeed, it is not by his own efforts, but by fortuitous external circumstances. Consistent with the metaphysics of fatalism or determinism, these literary works were dramatized histories or fictionalized biographies. They offered a recital of the events that had happened in the life of a man. The writer was, in effect, a biographer, a recorder of the given, the unalterable, the fated or determined. The emergence of a new literary form, the novel, in the late 18th century, represented a radical break with this tradition. The distinction of a novel is that it is a work of pure fiction, a story invented by its author and intended to be understood as such, rather than a fictionalized chronicle purporting to be a record of actual events. Romanticism was a literary school whose authors discarded the role of transcriber and assumed the role of creator. For the first time in literary history, a sharp line was drawn between fiction and journalism, between artistic creation and historical reporting. The romantic novelists did not make it their goal to record that which had happened, but to project that which ought to happen. They did not take the things man had done as the given, as the unalterable material of existence, like facts of physical nature, but undertook to project the things that man should choose to do. The concept of man as a being motivated by his chosen values lay at the base of the great artistic innovation and distinctive characteristic of the romantic novel, plot. Whereas a story is a series of contingently connected events, plot is a series of logically connected events. In the romantic plot novel, the course of man's life is determined by his chosen purpose, which he pursues through a series of relevant problems that he has to solve, of non-accidental obstacles that he has to overcome, of conflicts that he has to win, conflicts among his own values and/or conflicts with the values and purposes of others, through a series of coherent, integrated events leading to the climax of a final resolution. The concept of values as the crucial and determining element in human life is the central, dominant, and logically implicit premise of the romantic plot novel. But from its beginning, the romantic school harbored a contradiction which ultimately defeated it. The contradiction between the requirements of man's life on earth and the mystic altruist code of morality. The writers who dramatized the principle of man's free will, of man's efficacy, of his power to achieve his values and determine the course of his life, found, consciously or subconsciously, that the values of traditional morality were not applicable to this earth, could not be practiced, could not serve as man's guide to success or happiness. This is the reason why so many romantic novels, whose sense of life is essentially pro-man and pro-earth, have tragic endings, such as Hugo's Notre Dame de Perth or The Man Who Laughs. This is also the reason why so many romantic novels are laid in the past, in some remote period of history, with a marked preference for medieval history, such as the novels of Walter Scott or the costume novels of today, which are among the last remnants of the Romantic school. A novel dealing with the crucial problems of the author's time, such as Hugo's Les Miserables, is a rare exception. By escaping from the problems of the present, the Romanticists contradicted their own implicit basic philosophical belief in man's efficacy. They saw man as heroic, but life as tragic. They could not successfully project and concretize man's fulfillment on earth. Neither the traditional values of mysticism nor the defiantly subjective values of their own could make such fulfillment possible. Taking flight into the historical past, or else taking refuge in novels of impossibly unrealistic sentimentality, the romantic writers progressively became more and more vulnerable to the charge of escapism that was being raised against their work. The contradiction they were unable to resolve forced them to retreat further and further from the actual problems of human existence, and ultimately to abandon all serious issues and concerns. Their work degenerated into the class of light fiction, which is its predominant status today. Naturalism, the literary counter-revolution against Romanticism, was a regression to a pre-Romantic view of man, to a view lower than that against which the Romanticists had rebelled. It was naturalism that reintroduced the fate motif into literature and once more presented man as the helpless plaything of irresistible forces. Consistent with the philosophical doctrines that were gaining ascendancy, the naturalists gave fate a new form. It was not the omnipotent power of the gods, nor the omnipotent power of tragic flaws, but the omnipotent power of society. It is society, the naturalist declared, or family, or upbringing, or social caste, or economic status, that determines man's destiny. Naturalists claim that the purpose of literature, including the novel, is to transcribe life as it really is, meaning as the people around them are living it, to present men as they really are, meaning as the men they observe are, not as they ought to be. No ought to be is possible, assert the naturalists, and no moral values and no moral choices, because a man cannot help being what he is. Man is the product of his background. His life and character are determined by forces beyond his control. With the rise of this school in the second half of the 19th century, a writer once more became a man who holds up a mirror to life, and it was added he must have the courage to let his mirror reflect the lowest, the ugliest, the most sordid aspects of nature, human nature. He must do so because he must be honest. He must admit that the essence of existence is ugliness, futility, doom, and defeat. What followed in the history of literature is a procession of men with mirrors, which defies the laws of optics by the fact that the men in the mirror shrink as they come closer to us, instead of growing larger in stature, so that what began as ballroom mirrors reflecting the destinies of nations is now dentist mirrors in the hands of men peering into rat holes. Today, the romantic method of writing has been all but forgotten. Many commentators speak as if it were an axiom that all fiction is to be judged by the canons of naturalism, as if no other school had ever existed. In their view and by their sense of life, to project man as being moved by his chosen values and to show him at his heroic potential is unrealistic. Only the helpless, the passive, the sordid, the depraved are real. If Romanticism was defeated by the fact that its values were removed from this world, the alternative offered by naturalism was to remove values from literature. The result today is an aesthetic vacuum, left by the historical implication that men's only choice is between artistic projections of near fantasy or Sunday supplement exposés, gossip columns, and psychological case histories parading as novels. It is against the background of the despair, the exhausted cynicism, and the unremitting drabness that have settled over contemporary literature that the novels of Ayn Rand have appeared. Ayn Rand has brought values back to literature and back to this earth. She has chosen to write about the most fundamental and urgent issues of our age, and to use them as the material of romantic art. In her novels, the ruling values are applicable to reality. They can be practiced. They can serve as man's guide to success and happiness. As a result, her heroes predominantly win their battles. They achieve their goals. They succeed practically and in their own lives. Anthem, The Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged do not end with heroic death, but with heroic victory. Her work is an accomplished embodiment of Aristotle's definition of the proper function of literature. Things as they might be is the principle of realism. It means that fiction must stay within the bounds of reality and not indulge in fantasies concerning the logically or metaphysically impossible. Things as they ought to be is the principle of romanticism. It means things objectively possible and proper to man, things which he can and ought to choose. She does not face man with the camera of a photographer as her tool, but with the chisel of a sculptor. Howard Rourke, Hank Reardon, Francisco D'Anconia, and John Galt are not statistical composites of men as they are. Rather, they are projections of man as he might be and ought to be. They are projections of the human potential. On the premise of naturalism, such heroes as these are incomprehensible. One does not meet them around every corner. One may never in one's own lifetime meet them at all. But in projecting such figures, Miss Rand does not ask, do such men exist? She asks, should such men exist? That is the premise of art, as against the premise of history or biography. It is not a mirror reflecting the things behind them that her work holds up to men, but rather a beacon to be reached ahead. An understanding of the principle by which her characters, heroes and villains, are created is essential to an understanding of her literary method as a whole. Discussing this aspect of her work, she has written, "Readers have asked me whether my characters are copies of real people in public life or not human beings at all, but symbols. Neither is true. What I did was to observe real life, analyze the reasons which make people such as they are, draw an abstraction, and then create my own characters out of that abstraction. My characters are persons in whom certain human attributes are focused more sharply and consistently than in average human beings." Whether she is presenting a Howard Rourke or a Peter Keating or a John Galt or a Wesley Mouch, the principle of characterization is the same. To present a character by means of essentials, that is, to focus on the actions and attributes which reflect the character's basic values and premises, the values and premises that motivate him and direct his crucial choices. A successful characterization is one which makes a man distinguishable from all other men and makes the causes of his actions intelligible. To characterize by essentials is to focus on the universal, to omit the accidental, the irrelevant, the trivial, the contingent, and to present the fundamental motivational principles which are potentially applicable to all men. The characterization of Howard Rourke, for instance, is a thoroughly individualized portrait. Rourke is unique and unforgettable in manner, in speech, in temperament, in personality. Yet in his basic premises and goals, in the opposition he encounters and in the battle he fights, his life and struggle project an abstraction that is timeless. Rourke is not an American architect of the 1940s. He is the independent innovator of intransigent integrity in any profession and in any century. Consider the scene in the Fountainhead in which Rourke, at a time when he is destitute, is offered an enormously important commission, one which would virtually make his career. He is told that the commission is his on one condition, that he agree to modify the unconventional design of his building. A member of the board of directors shows Rourke a sketch of the kind of change the board desires. Quote, "It was Rourke's building on the sketch, very neatly drawn. It was his building, but it had a simplified Doric portico in front, a cornice on top, and his ornament was replaced by a stylized Greek ornament. Rourke got up. He had to stand. He concentrated on the effort of standing. It made the rest easier. He leaned on one straight arm, his hand closed over the edge of the table, the tendons showing under the skin of his wrist. Unquote. Rourke listens to their assurances that the changes do not spoil anything, and then he answers, again, quote, "He spoke for a long time. He explained why this structure could not have a classic motive on its facade. He explained why an honest building, like an honest man, had to be of one piece and one faith. What constituted the life source, the idea in any existing thing or creature, and why, if one smallest part committed treason to that idea, the thing or the creature was dead, and why the good, the high, and the noble on earth was only that which kept its integrity." Unquote. They inform him that the board's decision is unalterable, that Rourke may be right, but, quote, "in practical life one can't always be so flawlessly consistent," unquote. And then the scene continues as one of the board speaks to Rourke, quote, "You understand the situation, Mr. Rourke?" "Yes," said Rourke. His eyes were lowered. He was looking down at the drawings of his building. "Well?" Rourke did not answer. "Yes or no, Mr. Rourke?" Rourke's head leaned back. He closed his eyes. "No," said Rourke. After a while, the chairman asked, "Do you realize what you're doing?" "Quite," said Rourke. "Good God," Weidler cried suddenly. "Don't you know how big a commission this is? You're a young man. You won't get another chance like this. And, all right, damn it all, I'll say it. You need this. I know how badly you need it." Rourke gathered the drawings from the table, rolled them together, and put them under his arm. "It's sheer insanity," Weidler moaned. "I want you. We want your building. You need the commission. Do you have to be quite so fanatical and selfless about it?" "What?" Rourke asked incredulously. "Fanatical and selfless." Rourke smiled. He looked down at his drawings. His elbow moved a little, pressing them to his body. He said, "That was the most selfish thing you've ever seen a man do." Unquote. In this scene, the author, by the strict purposefulness of her writing, by that which she chooses to include and to omit, dramatizes and makes real the naked essence of Rourke as a man, the sovereign consciousness, the unyielding independence of judgment, the passion for his work, the willingness to pay any price for that passion, for his work done his way. And because Rourke is presented in this manner, because his is not a naturalistic portrait burdened with trivia, he is not less but more real to the reader. More real because he is presented in the sharp focus of purposeful stylization. To write and to characterize by means of essentials requires that one know what is essential and what is derivative, what is a cause and what is a consequence. It is by identifying causes that one arrives at basic principles. No such understanding is required by the naturalist method of characterization. Let me explain what I mean by this. A naturalist observes that men act in a certain manner. He does not ask why. On the premise of determinism, he explicitly or implicitly assumes that somehow men's heredity and environment force them to act as they do. Since he sees himself as a historical observer, as a recorder of the given, what he offers as characterization and motivational explanation is a haphazard collection of surface details, a string of concretes without any abstract significance, such as a character's preference in automobiles, his use of the slang typical of a particular region in a particular year, his random thoughts while brushing his teeth, the restaurants he frequents, the newspapers he reads, and the geographical location of his old high school. Sometimes, if a contemporary writer feels that this is not quite adequate, he may toss in a few Freudian slogans to add depth to his characterization. Any sort of causal analysis beyond the most primitive and obvious level is alien to the naturalist approach. If, for instance, a naturalist decides to write about a Madison Avenue executive, he projects that a Madison Avenue executive does the things he does because, well, you know, because he's a Madison Avenue executive. Naturalist literature is filled with portraits on this level of profundity. A typical Bronx housewife, a typical ruthless business tycoon, a typical French coal miner, a typical frustrated and bored French housewife longing for a lover, a typical member of the Russian landed nobility, etc. This, to a naturalist, is characterization. Aggressive social climbers, men such as Peter Keating, exist in large numbers. The type has been treated extensively in countless naturalist novels. If Ayn Rand's presentation of this type has already achieved the status of a psychological classic, the reason is that Ayn Rand, observing the behavior of such men, asked why, and built Peter Keating's characterization on the answer. As illustration of the difference between the naturalist method of cataloging journalistic surface details and the romantic method of characterization by essentials, contrast the innumerable naturalist presentations of aggressive social climbers with the characterization of Peter Keating. If you have difficulty clearly calling to mind a specific naturalist portrait to serve as contrast with Peter Keating, that is the point. There have been superlatively observant naturalist writers such as Sinclair Lewis, who have provided impressively exact portraits of the manners, the speech habits, the practices of a certain type of American in a certain region of the country during a certain period. These portraits may have value as sociological reports, but then they should be identified as such, and if sociological instructiveness is the virtue to be claimed for naturalism, why then it should be recognized that naturalism and not romanticism deserves the charge of being didactic. To those who share the naturalist view of literature and the view of life from which it comes, to those who do not understand and or who resent the principle of artistic stylization and the perspective of philosophical essentials, it is superficial and unconvincing, for instance, to present John Galt as a man motivated by an inviolate self-esteem, an unlimited ambition, a passionate love of existence, and a total commitment to reason. Whereas it would be profound, it would add depth to Galt's characterization if he were shown combing his hair in the morning, drinking cough medicine when he has a cold, and stopping to chat with the grocer when he buys a pound of coffee. After all, doesn't Galt comb his hair? Doesn't even he occasionally catch a cold? Doesn't he go to the grocer to buy coffee? Isn't this too part of life? Why does Ayn Rand choose to discriminate against such vital aspects of reality? The answer, of course, is that such events are omitted because they are of no importance, neither to the plot, nor to the theme, nor to Galt's characterization, nor to Galt. The standard by which events are selected in a properly constructed novel is objective importance and relevance to the purpose that is being dramatized. Ayn Rand's attitude in this matter is perhaps best illustrated by the following incident. A young man once expressed concern as to whether he could live up to the heroes in her novels, and he offered her this example. If John Galt, the young man said, were preparing to pour champagne for a girl, he would open the bottle swiftly, smoothly, and efficiently, and the scene would be very glamorous. But in real life, the cork might be stuck, and he, the young man, would have difficulty in opening the bottle, and the mood of the occasion would be marred. Why cannot real life be more like art? He wanted to know. Ayn Rand answered that the young man's error was in being upset if the cork stuck, that he was wrong to attach any importance to it. A John Galt might very well have trouble in opening the bottle if the cork stuck, she explained, but he would attach no significance to it. His attention and emotional focus would be on the girl and the evening. That is what would be important to him, not any momentary mishap. And she formulated the principle thus. In life, one ignores the unimportant. In art, one omits it. Since art necessarily is selective, to include an incident in a novel is to make it important. To include the unimportant is to magnify it and give it equal status with the important, thus undercutting the important. Those who wish that Galt had been given a few accidental or irrelevant touches have but one basic motive, whether they choose to identify it or not. To see Galt undercut, to see his stature diminished, to see his certainty and his self-esteem breached. They believe that what they are objecting to is his characterization. In fact, what they are objecting to is his character. There is a scene in The Fountainhead in which Peter Keating resentfully asks Howard Roark, quote, "Can't you be human for once in your life? Can't you ever relax? Do you always have to be so damn serious? Can't you ever do things without reason, just like everybody else? Everything's important with you. Everything's great, significant in some way, every minute, even when you keep still. Can't you ever be comfortable and unimportant?" Unquote. If one understands Keating's psychology in this scene, one understands the psychology of those who find Galt unreal or inhuman. The method by which Ayn Rand characterizes the villains in her novels is, following the same principle of selectivity, to focus on the actions and reactions that hold the key to their fundamental motivations. One of the most fascinating and complex of these characterizations is that of Dr. Robert Stadler in Atlas Shrugged. Dr. Stadler is shown as a great mind, genuinely devoted to science, but willing, in exchange for a laboratory, to work for the practitioners of brute force, the looters in control of the state. He is irresistibly and almost pathetically drawn to the intelligence of Dagny Taggart, in whose eyes he attempts to justify himself, but then snarls at her his contempt for all industrialists, of which she is one, because of their vulgar concern with practical pursuits. He worships and longs for the genius of his former student, John Galt, but at the end of a long series of betrayals, he is driven by his own guilt to seek his idol's death. "What can you do when you have to deal with people?" cries Dr. Stadler throughout the novel. At first, it is the bewildered cry of a great intellect who feels himself caught in a swamp of mediocrity. At the end, it is the vicious rationalization of an evader who has acquired a vested interest in men's evil as a sanction and excuse for his own. James Taggart is a villain of a different order. Whereas Stadler is a man of better premises who commits treason to his values, Taggart has no better premises and no values to betray. From his first introduction in the story, "Don't bother me, don't bother me, don't bother me," said James Taggart, he is shown as a whim worshipper, a resentful and pretentious mediocrity moved by terror a hatred for ability, and an insatiable craving for power. This is the theme and the leitmotif of all his crucial actions, and this is the aspect from which he is presented. A real-life James Taggart may have his evil concealed beneath many confusing and contradictory surface attributes, but that precisely is the virtue of art, that it penetrates the smokescreen of the superficial, the irrelevant, and the accidental, and shows the essence that lies beneath. The same mentality that complains of Galt's characterization because Galt has given no flaws complains of Taggart's characterization because Taggart has given no virtues. It is not a literary issue at all, but a moral and psychological one. It is two sides of the same coin and the same psychological confession. To insist that there is some bad in the best of us and to plead that there is some good in the worst of us. An apparent good that will be sold out and betrayed every time it clashes with a basic evil is not an actual good. It is morally irrelevant to a man's character. That a concentration camp sadist may bring his mother flowers every Sunday does not mean that he is less than totally evil. That a James Taggart may have his moments of remorse does not mean that he is less than totally evil. That a James Taggart may have his moments of remorse does not mean that he is less than totally evil. If one wishes to understand the motives of those who are made uncomfortable by such moral absolutism, and who prefer to assert that no one can be wholly good or wholly bad, consider this. A John Galt has nothing to gain by such a doctrine, but a concentration camp sadist and a James Taggart have. Once, after having delivered an address to members of the publishing profession, Ayn Rand was asked, "What are the three most important elements in a novel?" She answered, "Plot, plot, plot." "The most beautifully written novel that lacks a plot," she explained, "is like a superbly outfitted automobile that lacks a motor." Plot, as stated previously, is central and basic to the romantic novel. It proceeds from the concept of man as a being of free will who must choose his values and struggle to achieve them. The logical progression is choice, therefore values, therefore the necessity of action to achieve them, therefore the possibility of conflict, therefore plot. Action and effort are necessities of survival, of the achievement of any values. They are inherent in the nature of human life. Conflict results from the fact that A, man's values may clash with one another, and B, man's values may clash with the values and purposes of others. Both A and B are possible since men are neither infallible nor omniscient. Either a man achieves his values and goals, or he is defeated. In the novel, the manner in which this issue is resolved constitutes the climax. Thus, plot is not, as the naturalists have contended, an artificial contrivance that belies the actual facts of reality and the nature of human life. Plot is the abstraction of man's relation to existence. Purpose is the ruling principle in Ayn Rand's novels in two basic respects. First, all the characters are motivated by their purposes, by the goals they are seeking to achieve, and the events of the novel dramatize the conflicts of these purposes. Second, the author is purposeful. That is, every event, every character, and every adjective is selected by the standard of the logical requirements of the novel. Nothing is accidental and nothing is included for reasons extrinsic to the needs of the plot and the theme. Every novel, by the nature of art, carries an implicit philosophical meaning. But Ayn Rand's plots dramatize an explicit philosophical theme. In We the Living, the abstract theme is, quote, the individual against the state, the supreme value of a human life, and the evil of the totalitarian state that claims the right to sacrifice it. In Anthem, it is, quote, the meaning of man's ego, unquote. In The Fountainhead, it is, quote, individualism versus collectivism, not in politics, but in man's soul. The psychological motivations and the basic premises that produce the character of an individualist or a collectivist. Unquote. In Atlas Shrugged, it is the role of the mind in man's existence, and as a corollary, the demonstration of a new moral philosophy, the morality of rational self-interest, unquote. Ayn Rand defines a plot theme as the central situation that expresses and dramatizes a novel's abstract theme. Thus, the plot theme of We the Living is the struggle of three young and talented people to achieve life and happiness in Soviet Russia, and the manner in which the system destroys all three of them, not in spite of, but because of their virtues. In Anthem, it is the struggle of a young scientist to discover the concept of ego in a totally collectivized society of the future from which the word I has vanished. In The Fountainhead, it is the battle of a great innovator, an architect of genius, against a society geared and committed to mediocrity. In Atlas Shrugged, it is the mind on strike. In contradistinction to the typical philosophical novel, such as, for instance, Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, the characters in Ayn Rand's books who hold opposing views do not merely sit on verandas or on mountaintops and debate or argue their theoretical convictions while all action is suspended. Every idea, every issue, and every intellectual conflict in these novels is dramatized, that is, presented in terms of action, in terms of the practical consequences to which it leads. Quoting Miss Rand, quote, I am interested in philosophical principles only as they affect the actual existence of men, and in men only as they reflect philosophical principles. An abstract theory that has no relation to reality is worse than nonsense. And men who act without relation to principles are less than animals. Those who say that theory and practice are two unrelated realms are fools in one and scoundrels in the other. I wanted to present my abstract theory where it belongs, in concrete reality, in the actions of men, unquote. The ingenuity and artistry of Ayn Rand as a plot writer lies in the nature of the situation she creates, in her sense of drama and conflict, and in her integration of philosophy and action. Consider the basic plot situation in We the Living. In order to obtain money to send Leo Kovalensky, the man she loves, to a tuberculosis sanatorium, Kira Argunova becomes the mistress of Andrei Tiganov, an idealistic communist. Neither man knows of Kira's relationship with the other, and both men hate each other. Leo is an aristocrat, Andrei a member of the Soviet secret police. Now, the situation of a woman forced to sleep with a man she does not love in order to save the life of the man she does love is not new. That is the situation in Tosca, for instance, and in many other stories. The originality of Miss Rand's treatment of the subject from the point of view of plot is in the way she intensifies the conflict and makes it more complex. In Tosca, and in stories like it, the man to whom the woman sells herself is an unequivocal villain whom the woman despises. He knows that she is selling herself for the sake of another man, and it is he, the villain, who has forced the action upon her. But in We the Living, Andrei is not a villain. He is profoundly in love with Kira and believes that she is in love with him. He does not know of her love for Leo, and Kira does not despise him. Increasingly, she comes to respect him. At the start of their affair, she had acted in desperation, knowing that this was her only chance to save Leo, and knowing that Andrei had helped to establish the system that forced such an action upon her. But as their relationship progresses, as Andrei finds the first happiness he has ever known, he begins to understand the importance of an individual life and begins to doubt the ideals for which he has fought. And thus, the conflicts involved and the suspense about what will happen when the two men find out about each other are brought to the highest intensity. One of the most brilliantly dramatic scenes occurs at the climax of the novel when, arriving to arrest Leo for illegal activities, Andrei finds Kira's dresses in the closet of Leo's apartment and learns the truth of Kira's and Leo's relationship at the moment when he holds Leo's life in his hands. In presenting the evil of dictatorship, Miss Rand does not focus primarily on the aspect of physical brutality and horror, on the concentration camps, the executions without trial, the firing squads, and the torture chambers. These elements are present in We the Living only in the background. Had these horrors been the primary focus, the impact would be less profound, because violence and bloodshed necessarily suggest a state of emergency, of the temporary. Miss Rand achieves a far more devastating indictment of dictatorship by focusing on the normal daily conditions of existence. The spectacle of men reduced to a chronic, intense, humiliating preoccupation with the barest physical necessities. The spectacle of endless posters and endless speeches proclaiming man's duty to the state. In a world where a private life is forbidden, where one's leisure hours are drained away in public meetings, parades, social activity conferences, and voluntary demonstrations. The spectacle of squirming mediocrities scrambling for power. The power to rule a nation or to control a committee or to dispossess one's neighbor. The spectacle of a system where servility and treachery are the currency of survival and virtue and ability are one's passport to destruction. The spectacle of a world where lives, careers, aspirations, and futures are throttled by a mindless, impersonal machine controlled by hysterical thugs, the profiteers of the doctrine that man has no right to exist for his own sake. In the course of the novel, Leo was arrested twice, and Kira does not know if he is to be tortured, executed, or if she is ever to see him again. In the end, he is released, physically unarmed. to go on living in a world where such threats are the constant and the normal. The impact is far worse than if he had been executed. Leo is destroyed spiritually. Another crucial element contributing to the power of Miss Rand's indictment of collectivism is the fact that she presents André sympathetically. He is not the worst representative of the system, but the best, the most idealistic and sincere. And that is why, as the events of the novel demonstrate with inexorable logic, he is as inevitably doomed to destruction as Kira and Leo. It is his virtues that make his survival impossible. Now, in our next lecture, we will continue our discussion of Miss Rand's literary style, and I want to discuss some of the plot features of Anthem, the Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged, and then we will move on to consider still other aspects of Miss Rand's literary method. So, ladies and gentlemen, to be continued. Thank you.